Welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, Monolith. This little mysterious horror gem is like a cross between Pontypool, No One Will Save You, with maybe a dash of Arrival. I'm going to do a spoiler-free dive into this movie at first, and then I'll give a warning, and then I'm going to cover spoilers later on in the episode. I'll definitely warn you off because you should go into this movie without spoilers if you haven't seen it yet and you're interested in, which I recommend you should be. But this is the kind of movie that once you're done watching it, you're just dying to talk to someone about it. It's the kind of movie where you might end up in a conversation outside the theater with total strangers just like trying to figure out, what the hell did you just witness? And I can't do justice to that vibe without going into spoilers. So I'll do that later on. And at the back half of this episode, I will talk a little bit about True Detective Night Country's season 4 finale, which, as predicted, was super divisive. But I'm going to give the community, the Horror Weekly community's thoughts, as well as my own. So the log line for Monolith, which is dated 2022, which I find hard to believe considering it's just coming out now, but there's an interesting backstory to the movie itself. The logline is, while trying to salvage her career, a disgraced journalist begins investigating a strange conspiracy theory. However, as the trail leads uncomfortably close to home, she's left to grapple with the lies at the heart of her own story. So Monolith is directed by Matt Vesely and written by Lucy Campbell and stars Lily Sullivan from Evil Dead Rise and Picnic at Hanging Rock fame. Interestingly, Monolith was the first feature film produced as part of an initiative called Film Lab New Voices from the South Australian Film Corporation. It was a development lab that ran for almost a year, and three projects chosen from 63 entries proposed by almost 50 teams. They all developed their scripts. One script was then chosen for production. So Monolith was awarded the production, and the film's total budget is near $500,000 only. It's a really stripped-down, minimalist movie. It was shot over only 15 days. It was shot consecutively in the same order as the events in the film, which I find super interesting. It's basically a one-location film and basically one character on screen the entire time, which scared Lily Sullivan to death. She said in a interview in 2023 that the role was the challenge of a lifetime and was terrifying, which I can understand as a prospect of carrying an entire movie on your back. And she said she ended up approaching it like theater almost, and that she's never been so aware of her own voice. And it's a weird coincidence that this ended up getting paired with the True Detective finale, because they're going to have a lot in common in terms of storytelling, the importance of storytelling, unreliable narrators, and a really intense feeling of isolation from both productions. So the main character, Lily Sullivan's character in Monolith, we don't even get her name, I don't think. She's referred to as the interviewer, so that's what I'll call her. She runs a podcast. We find out she is a journalist who got knocked down to a lower tier of podcasting by a very mysterious scandal that she just came out of, where it seems that she ended up accusing someone of being guilty, that she's still sure is guilty of something, but her one source that she was relying on, or the main source she was relying on to make these accusations, turned out to not be credible, and it brought her career to a kind of low point. As a matter of fact, the backlash against this event in her life has gotten intense enough where she's been doxxed, and she has to go to her parents' house, which is an incredible house, by the way. It's a lot like the house in Parasite, at least in terms of the impact it has on the film, and kind of like it's almost a character in itself, because we spend our entire time of the movie almost entirely at this location. So, well, let's call her Lily. Lily is hanging out at her parents' house, licking her wounds, trying to figure out what the next step to make in her life is now that she's embroiled in this scandal. And she's been offered a job starting a podcast called Beyond Believable. The person who offers her this job tells her in a voicemail, I think, or an email, I know this is like lower content than you're used to, but like, you know, the implied thing is you don't have anywhere else to go and let's get this thing going. She's ignoring his messages hilariously since she has no other job options seemingly. And this sets a really interesting tone to the movie and a little nuanced behind the glass look at the character. I didn't pick it up. I picked it up subconsciously the first time I watched the movie. Once I knew what was happening in the movie, it was way more obvious. This is a great movie. It's really rich to watch on a second or third watch, which is really fun. But she's a hustler, you can tell, but she also is completely not desperate or up against the wall, even though she has no other job options. And because she's staying in her parents' house and because her parents are obviously extremely well off from the size and design of the house, we get the sense that she's not doing this for finances. She's doing this from drive, from trying to establish herself in some sense and get things done. There's an interesting parallel, like when once you find out that Anderson Cooper, the longtime anchor on CNN, is from the Vanderbilt family, like one of the wealthiest families in the world, but he's just out there, you know, hosting this show year after year after year after year, when he clearly doesn't have to work a minute in his life. You feel like this is kind of that scenario, but on a much smaller scale. Now, the reason that she's not launching the first episode of Beyond Believable is she has no idea what the topic should be. She knows the format of the podcast, which is kind of like a paranormal, unsolved mysteries, conspiracy theory-esque kind of podcast, but she doesn't have a story, and she's waiting for a story, and then fortuitously, she hears a notification ding from her computer while she's stressing out about what to do, and she receives a mysterious email with the subject line, "The truth will out." I love that this is all centered around a Shakespeare quote from Merchant of Venice specifically, since Shakespeare is my favorite creator of all time. So I was all in from the start. The email's from Anonymous. She tries to reply to it and ask who this is. It says that the mail can't be delivered, her send mail. And once she opens it up, there's a name, Flora Mae King, a plus sign, the words "The Brick," and then a grainy JPEG of presumably Flora Mae King herself. And this is all she has to go on. And I should mention before we get into the mystery of the ominous black brick, or bricks, plural, it's going to turn out. I should mention this movie starts really compellingly with an interview she obviously recorded as maybe the possible subject for the first episode of Beyond Believable. But the interview goes really sideways really fast. It's just a black screen and you're just hearing a voice and seeing the words. And the interview starts promising with a mystery of like a family being stalked and a lot of photos being taken of them and a mysterious camera. But the interview devolves into something that has no evidence behind it. And then she judges, even though she's not supposed to, maybe that's a little harsh. She assesses that this person's story isn't going to be enough to anchor the first episode on because he has absolutely zero evidence or trace of any of the things he's relating happening. And he gets really pissed at her. He even brings up the fact that he knows that she's a scandalous person who has done unethical things. He starts screaming at her. He hilariously at some point calls himself fucking Harry Potter, and she hangs up on him. But he starts with the words, "I want to tell you a story. I have a secret." And it's really cool way to start the movie. And it's going to have a wraparound effect that is magnificent. So Lily calls Flora Mae King. She coaxes her story of the brick out of her because she's reluctant to say anything about it all. She's like, it's a long time ago. The details are fuzzy, but it was a horrible moment in my life. It changed my entire life. I received this mysterious brick. I felt like it had some kind of unusual power. And then it was taken away from me by a family I worked for, stolen from me. And then they sold it without my permission to a German art collector named Lang. So Lily follows up on this without a lot of hope of this turning out to be her podcast's subject either. I mean, it's a brick. It's about a brick. It sounds ludicrous. But it gets a lot more interesting when she tracks down Lang, who says that he has many of these bricks. He's purchased some. He mysteriously received one himself, which is what made him aware of their existence. He has a few in his possession. He also hints at some kind of mysterious, sinister power these bricks have. He also says that he took them to have a volumetric scan done of them, and that they're filled with mysterious writings and symbols. Even though the exteriors of the brick are all identical, the interiors are different. And they might even be personalized in some weird way to the people who are receiving them. And she follows this thread of this story through, well, actually, that's not how it goes. What she does is she determines she's got enough to do the first podcast episode. It's still a little tenuous because it's still about mysterious bricks. But she's under pressure from her boss and she's like, let's just do it. She makes the first episode. It has a great download numbers, causes quite a stir. And then she starts getting contacted by people who are also experiencing this brick phenomenon. And that's where the movie gets fascinating. Because people seem to be receiving these bricks at really pivotal and awful moments of their lives. And the bricks seem to also be changing their lives almost the way an illness would. And that's where I'm going to leave this story before the spoiler warning. So let me just talk in a general sense about what I loved about Monolith. It shares a lot of its vibe and maybe visual DNA with Ex Machina. It looks so much better than its budget. It's an absolutely gorgeous film. It has a little sneaky misdirection to it. So one good sign that I have for a movie is I was watching this thing. I was a little tired the first time I watched it. I was thinking to myself I was going to go get some coffee, and I was kind of, it wasn't on purpose, I was kind of subconsciously waiting for like a break moment or a lull, and I ended up watching the entire damn film without any coffee because there was no point where I could really pull away from it because I just wanted to know what was coming next. It was like eating an amazing meal that someone's about to clear away from the table and you're just trying to get the last bite before they take it away. So the sneaky misdirection part is it's one character, Lily, who's already has some threats floating around, threats online. She's been doxxed. So you should feel really nervous for her in an isolated location in what is essentially a horror movie. But because she's driving so hard to interview people and discover what's going on with this evil black brick phenomenon, you're so, or at least for me as a viewer, I was so into the story, I wasn't noticing how vulnerable she was in the place she was located. And it's not until the movie takes a turn and she starts getting actual intrusions into her space by, I won't say yet, that it turns on a dime, a switch gets flipped, and you realize that she is all alone in a very isolated environment and is in, you're a danger, girl. Now, in most horror movies I watch, like the aforementioned No One Will Save You, I clocked that the character was in danger from her isolated state just from the start. I mean, you know from the second the Torrances walk into the Overlook Hotel in the beginning of The Shining that they're in big trouble. But the investigative unsolved mysteries piece at the beginning of this is so encompassing. I was like, she's so confident, the character, that I felt no danger until it was too late to sense it. And that is a really cool thing when it happens in a horror movie, because that's what's happening to the characters. A disconnect that often happens in horror movies is you're watching from afar, you're a spectator, but you can't really identify with the characters. You're like, oh my God, why are you going upstairs? Why are you going in the basement? How could you not know? How are you not scared of those sounds? How did you not see that shadow? You're ahead of them. But in this movie, I was surprised by the sudden arrival of a physical presence. I was as surprised as she was at the exact moment she was. Now, Lily Sullivan is incredible in Monolith, and she had to be because it's all on her. We do hear other voices. We do see visuals in other settings through like video screens or flashbacks, but we're basically with her the whole time. And on my second watch of the film, it was mind-boggling to me how believable the interviews and conversations she was having, not just with interview subjects, but also with her parents, and with her friends, with her boss. When you're just, the camera's really just kind of fixed on her face. This is a particular thing with me. I feel like when I watch a show or a movie and someone's on the phone, a lot of times you just get that sense that they're just not talking to the other person at all. They're just acting, even if they're good, even if they're a great actor. It's just a really hard thing to pull off. To center an entire movie around this and have her be pitch perfect the entire time with every like micro facial expression matching exactly what you think would be happening with a character built this way, hearing the words that she's hearing, incredible. She also has to juggle the public-facing nature of her job, podcasting, and how she has the demeanor she has to have in interviews to get people to talk, to get people to spill their secrets, to get people to go farther than they probably want to. She has this very calm, very supportive, but very real, very authentic. There's a great moment when she first calls the art collector Lang, and she says, "I'm recording this. Is that okay?" And he goes, "Wait, you're already recording?" And she says, "I find it's better to ask for forgiveness than for permission." And he laughs because that's pretty clever. And she doesn't have to say that, right? She could just say, "Is it okay if I record?" He says, "Yes." She goes, "Okay, I'm recording." I mean, it's what, 10 seconds of like whatever? But it's like that authenticity that kind of puts people at ease and disarms them. And we're going to find out later that she's not nearly as authentic as she seems. But like I said, this is her public-facing persona. Now, we contrast that with the actual her that we also get to spend time with when she's not interviewing people, when she's just being herself. And what I like about this is you can see the nice, calm persona part of her in her personality. It's definitely a piece there. It's not like she's faking it. This isn't like one of those movies like The Last Exorcism, say, where the person's the opposite of kind of the persona they're playing. She, you can tell that she's just digging up a side of her personality to put forward when she's dealing with people. And she's that personality, but she's also something else. And that something else is, one, ferociously smart, two, really ambitious in her way. But the part I liked the most is the defiant. She's very, very defiant. There's a quiet ferocity to it that I find fascinating, because it's not like strength. I mean, she's strong, but it for different reasons. I wouldn't say that this is the part that makes her character a strong person. The ferocity has its own strength. It actually weakens her in some respects, because she burns some bridges with people. And you can tell she can't help it, which is the fact that she's getting all of this across in this very minimalist portrayal is awesome. And speaking of minimalism, everything about the movie is just stripped down to exactly what it needs, from the architecture of the house to the setting around it to the interviews themselves. You even see her at points doing the interview, and then when you hear the interview back, she's chopping it up and taking what she thinks is inessential out of the interview, sometimes bending the truth by doing it, but she's stripping things down to their bare essence. I went on a trip to Tokyo once upon a time, and I got fascinated with the Buddhist temples and the architecture and the Zen gardens that everyone knows, et cetera. And you can just tell that it's one or two elements at most. It's as minimal as you can get. There's a, like a calm to that, that has a weird edge to it. And that's what this movie is, from its cinematography to its script, to its acting, to the physical settings. It reminds me of what fascinated me about just that really minimalist, mysterious, there's not a lot here, but there's so much underneath the surface feel I got from that trip I took. Now, we're approaching the spoiler warning, and I'm going to dive into the ending and the mysteries of this film. But before I get there, I just want to say, as much as I love this movie, I've seen it 3 times in just the matter of a couple days. I enjoyed it that much. But it is a bit of a slow burn. It is very limited in terms of the location and how many actors there are, which is exactly one, if you're not counting the voices you hear. And it's got a real palpable sense of creeping dread. It was very unnerving. It kind of got to me the first time I watched it, when I went out for a walk at night, and it just was in my head and felt like, you know, things can go wrong and sideways for people so fast for such mysterious reasons. And then you're just looking around while you're outside at night. You're like, oh God, is this going to happen to me? So it is unsettling, but I wouldn't say there are a lot of scare scenes or a lot of like iconic horror moments. It's definitely more of an atmosphere piece. So if that is not your jam, if you didn't like Pontypool, you're not going to like this. All right, now let's do the spoilers. If you don't want to hear this, go see the movie, come back to this point, or just fast forward to hear me talking about True Detective. Now, I'm not going to spoil the whole plot. I don't need to. She is a lot more connected to this story personally than it first seems when you're watching it. Her family is also implicated in the crime of the theft of the original black brick, or at least the first one we become aware of in this movie. There's some great detective work she does to find out. Then she interviews her own dad for the podcast. There's the point where her dad's like, are you recording this? You would expose your own family on your ridiculous podcast? And by the way, the podcast throughout the course of the movie is just blowing up, like tons of reviews, getting more and more downloads, more and more reactions. It's basically going viral. But it turns out that Lily, the interviewer herself, is a part of the reason the Black Brick ruined Flora Mae's life. And the symbols in Flora Mae's brick that she sees through the volumetric scans actually turn out to be present in her own, in her parents' house, like literally matching what's inside the brick, carved onto a piece of furniture. And you'll discover as you watch the movie why all that is. And then probably the first horrifying, not unsettling, not unnerving, but horrifying moment of the movie is when she receives her brick. And the way she receives it is it appears inside of her and she has to vomit it out. It's an awful visual, awful sounds. Great acting from Lily going through this horrendous moment. It reminded me a little, in a very stripped down way, of the subway scene in Possession with Isabella Gianni. Not nearly as histrionic, but like in that body horror kind of way. And then one thing I love about this movie, and I caught it subconsciously on the first watch, but really nailed it down for myself on the second watch, is her character makes all the right decisions. She arms herself when she feels like someone comes to the door. She gets her phone in the hand to call the police right away. When the brick comes out, all these other people that she's interviewing are like hanging on to it. They're like, yeah, I think it talks to me, or it's ruining my life, but I feel like I need to keep it around. As soon as she sees it, on the floor after she pukes it out, she goes away, comes back like 10 seconds later with a hammer and starts smashing the shit out of it. When the alien arrives, she confronts it, and then as soon as she gets an opportunity, she just bolts, runs away. She doesn't like hide in a place where she's going to get trapped. She doesn't try to like reason with it. She just takes off like, my best chance is to get the hell out of here. She's a crisp thinker. She's making all the right horror movie decisions, which I appreciate. But let's talk about that ending. So it seems the brick that she smashes reassembles itself like Terminator at the end in the like lava setting factory, when it reconstitutes itself from the pieces after it gets shot hasta la vista style. The brick reconstitutes itself into a doppelganger of Lily herself, looking like her, exactly like her physically, but not carrying herself like her. It's like that thing that Christopher Reeve did with Superman, where he stood a certain way with his glasses off and he looked like Superman. And he stood the other way with his glasses on, he looked like Clark Kent. Even though he looks like the same person, he carries himself differently. The alien is carrying herself differently than Lily. So now we have two of Lily's character. This actually reminds me a lot of what happened in that movie Significant Other, which I don't think a lot of people have seen, but was also kind of like an ambiguous alien invasion of the body snatchers-esque kind of film with not a lot of characters in it. Actually pretty well done, but felt a lot more gimmicky than Monolith. Felt a lot more like a modern Twilight Zone episode blown up into a movie, whereas Monolith feels strangely expansive, like it deserves to be a film. But there's a doppelganger in Significant Other, and now we have a doppelganger in Monolith. And when she runs away from the alien version of her, it tracks her down almost instantly, like fucking Pepe Le Pew style. Like the cat runs and runs and runs manically all over the place, and he's just hopping along, and all of a sudden he's right behind her again. Or Jason Voorhees, Michael Myers style, whatever your preference is, just all of a sudden showing up after the chase, completely calm. They have a great scene where they confront each other, where she realizes she can't escape this alien. And then they both simultaneously say to each other, are you going to harm me? And I got goosebumps, because the idea of having a standoff with yourself and being unable to lie to yourself, unable to deceive yourself, unable to like not be able to read across the body language because it's yourself. And then they both look at each other after they ask the question, realize that it's going down. Like, they are going to try to kill each other. It's like that moment in Tombstone when Doc Holliday winks during the standoff and it sets off the gunfight. Like, you can just tell. And the other character's like, oh, shit. Or, you know, it's, oh, my God, I think is what one of the ERPs says. I forget. It's been a long time since I've seen that movie. But anyway, it's like that moment where it's a tense scene and all of a sudden you know it's going to go down. And so that there's that brief moment and then someone throws a match onto the puddle of gasoline and it blows up. So they're looking at each other. They say, are you going to harm me? They know they are. Then they both say, shit. Which is one of the few moments of comedy in the movie, even though it's also a very intense moment. And then they just go at each other. And then one of them kills the other one of them. Strangled to death, beaten to death, put rocks in their inner clothes, drags the body into the lake that's next to the house, and just sinks it. And then whoever the winner was, alien or original Lily, walks back into the house. Then she creates the next podcast episode of Beyond Believable and says, I'm not going to quote it all, but basically starts with where we started with this movie. I want to tell you a story. I have a secret. Then ominously, she says, by telling this story, I'm going to change everything. And then says, all you have to do is listen. Now, there was a piece in this movie earlier where it was hinted that Pontypool style, the brick phenomenon is being aided, or maybe it is itself, where people hear about people getting these bricks and then they get the bricks themselves. So it's almost like the sound of the story or hearing about the story is the virus, is part of either the alien invasion or the alien mechanism or the mental delusion or whatever's happening here. So by launching a new podcast episode with her character knowing that this is part of either the alien conspiracy or the virus, the brick disease itself, which it could be a mental disease, or who knows, it could actually be a virus in some sense, kind of like Pontypool was, or at least how I interpreted it. By launching the podcast episode, she's speeding this process along and obviously harming a lot more people. I was pretty disappointed with the theories that I've seen online about what the ending of this movie means. There's basically two interpretations. The first interpretation is that this is just Polanski's repulsion. She's completely in a mental spiral. She's imagining most of what we see in the movie. And it's really gotten to her. She's kind of snapped from guilt, from what she, the harm she did to this original family, from realizing that she's not a great person, and that she's going ahead with launching the podcast because she's completely mentally broken. And the other one is that it's an alien, you know, that's doing the podcast. The alien won the physical struggle, killed the original Lily, has taken her place, and is now launching the virus onto the world. Now, I think ultimately those really are the two options per se. The reason I'm disappointed with the reading is I didn't see any kind of details added into either one of those interpretations, because the movie gets kind of complicated depending on which one of these you choose. If the aliens are doing it, why mysterious little black bricks that are like the size of a gold bar and only a few humans at a time, even though maybe it grows exponentially from everyone listening to this podcast episode after this, but this seems like the most inefficient alien invasion or alien experiment that's ever been put to film, if that's what it is. The explanation for why it's a brick is more if it's Lily's story, if she mentally snapped, because we can believe that there actually was this one black brick, this one artifact, that felt mysterious somehow. I mean, I was like a rock collector when I was a kid. Like, I loved geodes, and like, people buy crystals and whatnot. We all know, like, if you find a really cool looking rock or buy a really cool crystal, you can feel like something's happening, or at least you can feel like this is just a really cool looking, feeling thing. If someone comes across this when they're young, they covet it, they steal it from someone who comes from a very poor family, and they come from a rich family, which exploits the poor family further, their parents take the brick and sell it for their own profit, stealing it from the poor family, and you were integral of that. We can see why the whole thing is focused around this brick, but that does not explain all the other bricks. The people who are calling in and giving her interviews saying they also have bricks, the art collector who not only has a bunch of them, but shows her a bunch of them on his video that he's taking in the basement of his gallery before he gets killed, presumably. So what I'm saying is there's a problem with both the alien invasion / experiment interpretation and the mental disintegration of this one character interpretation. And I'm not here to resolve this. I'm not smart enough to figure out if the filmmakers even had anything in mind besides giving us these two ambiguous interpretations. And we're going to see when I get to True Detective that explicitly Issa Lopez was exactly trying to give us both a supernatural and not non-supernatural interpretation. So it's very possible that's what's happening here. But I'm going to plant my flag in one place and say it's the alien thing. And here's briefly how I reason this out. So there's a pivotal moment that kind of quietly goes by really fast when Lily sidetracks her investigation of the bricks to search the idea of mass hallucinations or psychosis, reasoning to herself that maybe all these people who have these bricks that are making them do and say very strange things and behave in very strange ways, it's giving one person fantasies of throwing herself out a window. It's giving another person fantasies that their grandfather has been replaced by someone who looks exactly like the grandfather but isn't, which is key to note since that's what happens to Lily in the alien interpretation of the ending of this movie. And as she's searching mass psychosis phenomenon, she discovers an article by a journalist from a long time ago tying some mass psychotic phenomena to mysterious objects. So she calls and leaves her a message, gets her to call back, interviews her for the podcast, and asks her to explain what this article meant. And she gives like a backstory. Watch the movie. I don't want to go into all the details of it, but basically it boils down to there were people who were being possessed or being body snatched or behaving in very strange ways. They were all tied to mysterious objects. She wrote this article about it. The guy who was working for the government who was studying this with the NSA or CIA or whatever your mysterious government agency of choice is, they thought maybe the Russians were doing it because this article was written at the height of the Cold War, late 80s. But the idea here is she doesn't believe that the Russians were doing it. She doesn't believe the government ever figured out what was happening. The person who was studying it for the government ended up becoming psychotic himself and disappearing. And then the journalist lost track of the story. And there's a very interesting moment where this interview goes sour for Lily. She doesn't like what the journalist is hinting about the ties to her own brick phenomenon. She basically shuts down the journalist and says, "Thank you, I've got everything I need," blah, blah, blah. And the journalist just says, in a way, the first watch was innocuous, but the second watch I was like, this is kind of creepy. She just goes, "Good luck." Like she knows something really bad is happening. She also says she's been listening to Lily's podcast, which is interesting. Although, you know, when journalists contact each other, they do tend to research each other. And this would have been the thing that came up if you searched Lily's character, especially at this time, since the podcast was going super viral. But the thing that's of note to me here is she didn't say bricks. She said mysterious objects. And it was mysterious objects, plural. And I got the distinct impression the objects might not only have been different from the brick, but might have been different from each other. Now, I could be totally wrong. This could just be meant to be that the bricks were happening way back in the past and it was all bricks all the way down. And even if that's true, I think my interpretation is still going to mainly hold. It's just thinking of the objects as being other than the bricks set me down the path of what I ended up deciding what the movie meant was to me. I think the objects are meant, either Prometheus style, they were just left here. And the aliens aren't actually monitoring them at all. I mean, you don't have to, if you're like the Unabomber or someone who like spreads anthrax, you don't have to like go everywhere the anthrax goes. You just unleash it and then wait for the results. If you're an arsonist who starts a fire, you don't run around the whole forest checking out all the places the fire goes. You just need an origin point. If the aliens seeded the Earth with these mysterious objects waiting for them to work their evil will or evil effects, then they don't even necessarily have to be monitoring it. But the aliens themselves could be these objects. I mean, the brick, as far as I can tell, reconstitutes itself into the alien once it gets smashed. And I think this would be a really unique thing for this movie to have done, is to make the aliens inanimate objects. And this is the sneaky part, right? In No One Will Save You or any alien invasion movie I can think of, you see the UFOs, you see the lights, you get creeped out, and then you lock your doors, or like in signs, right? You get some glasses of water, you get ready for the aliens, and then you lock the doors, and when they're creeping around or floating above your house or doing whatever, you repel them, you fight against them, you throw water on them ridiculously, as the case may be. But these bricks are just being kept perpetually in the houses, in the places where they've arrived. No one's trying to repel them or get rid of them. The only person in the entire movie that even takes any kind of active move against them is Lily herself when she smashes it with the hammer. Imagine an alien invasion that would constituted like coffee mugs. They were just going to hide as coffee mugs and show up in more and more places until they were ready to just spring to life and take over. How would we stop that? Now, there's a lot of focusing in Monolith on the truth versus lies. And the key moment of the entire movie, as I read it, is when Lily finds out from the truth from her dad, records her dad. Her dad says, "Don't you dare publish this on the podcast and expose our family." And after she hangs up with him, she stares at the recorder, hovers her finger over the delete button. You were sure, at least I was sure, she wasn't going to delete it. She's been publishing everybody, even when people are, she's telling people, "I'm not going to publish what you say." She's been doing it. She's thirsty to make the podcast grow. This is really compelling material. And Flora Mae King herself, or Flora Mae's daughter, actually, tells her on the phone, "This is your chance to set things right. You lied to your parents about me vandalizing the furniture in their house. You lied about the brick being yours and not mine. You stole the brick from me and your parents sold it. They called the police on me. They gave me a criminal record. They ruined my life. You know all this happened. You just found out from your dad that this is all, that it's corroborated. Like, you don't remember this because you were really young, but I'm telling the truth, and the truth will out, as the email says, as Shakespeare says. This is your chance to set it right and tell the truth." And she deletes her father's recording and immediately gets sick and then immediately vomits up her own black brick. And the thing is, if you're trying to either possess all humanity or bring humanity down, or weaken the earth prior to an invasion, or you're just running some kind of sick, like everyone's in a simulation experiment, as you were doing a flyby of Earth as aliens, you were like, just drop this off and we'll monitor it and see, like, we'll do a lab experiment on the entire human race, whatever is going on here. If you were going to try to get this to spread, to go viral, who's more valuable to you? Truth tellers or liars? It's the liars that will spread conspiracy theories. The truth tellers will stop them. She deletes the truth and immediately becomes a bricklayer, so to speak. So I think her own guilt, mixed with her own fierce drive, is what gets tangled into the brick phenomenon. And maybe it's just bricks for her. I mean, she started it. It got sold to Lang, and God knows, maybe it just all spread from her. And the last time it happened, when the article was written in the 80s, it wasn't bricks. It was someone else's guilt. Maybe there's a patient zero, and then the virus grows and grows, and either takes over everything, spreads everywhere like COVID did, or it dies out like an endless number of diseases that try to spread and spread and then become extinct. But either way, I find the movie more satisfying if all the people she was talking to and interacting to weren't some kind of like hallucination of hers. If this wasn't just like the story of one person having an epic breakdown that we went along on a compelling ride with, but it had absolutely no impact on the world at all. There are things in the movie that cut against this a little bit. Like when Lang gets killed, she never follows up. Like, I immediately would have called 911 in Germany or whatever the hell their version of that number is and been like, can you go check on this guy? She puts it in the podcast episode and never gets a response of there's no such thing as a Lang, or like he's alive and well and he's just like at lunch, or he actually did get killed. We never find out. Like, it's weird that she wouldn't follow up on it. Although her investigation is moving pretty fast and she's in a lot of danger at that point. So whatever, but I could read the movie in the mental breakdown way if I tried really hard. I just don't find it nearly as satisfying the other way. So the way I'm going to take it is that there's an alien invasion or experiments going on. The aliens either are these inanimate objects or have seeded the earth with inanimate objects that spread like a disease, and then they can materialize when one of them is triggered. Although I love the idea of them being the objects themselves. There's a patient zero who starts a wave by being a liar, first of all, and then telling the story around or doing something that unleashes it from their environment into other people's environments, like stealing it from someone and selling it to someone else who becomes fascinated by it. But either way, they become a personalized viral phenomenon with symbols inside of them that relate to something that's meaningful to you in your life when you get the brick. And they come at a moment in your life when you're vulnerable to it. And that only leaves the final question, which is it Lily or the alien that's triumphant at the end if, as I do, you believe it's an alien and not Lily strangling a version of herself in her own mind and then her mind snapping and just going back into the house and doing her podcast like she's been doing it the whole movie. And I'm going to cut against the grain here. I know by my theory and the way I've been talking, you're going to expect me to say that it's the alien that won. I could totally see that. I think it's Lily who killed the alien in the struggle. And I'm basing it on the fact that the last time we see her, one of the last times we see her in the movie, she steps outside and has a cigarette. And that seems like an unusual thing for an alien to do with no one else around. I could see doing that if you're trying to act like Lily. Now, if the alien's an exact copy of Lily and behaves exactly like her, then sure. And I could totally see that. And that could absolutely be the end. She's definitely acting creepier at the end of the movie than she was happening before she had the fight with the alien. But I think that she killed the alien and has figured out what's happening and decided, fuck it, I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to spread this thing around. I have no qualms about it or morals about it. I am the bad person I thought I was and that you suspect I am when you're watching the film. Let's see how far I can push this. Let's see what happens. Let's see if I become the ally of the aliens. I know this is a dark interpretation, but it's the best I could come up with. Now, it's very possible the director is going to come out with an interview about this movie, say something definite, and that means I just wasted a bunch of your time. But you know what? Like, viewers have their own right to their own interpretations. I believe in David Lynch's philosophy however the movie best hits you, that's the way you should take it. So I absolutely love Monolith. It's not like a perfect movie. I'm not going to give it like 100 stars or anything like that, but it's definitely, to me, a great film. One that really quietly sneaks up on you and hugely enjoyable. And even if you don't like slow burns or you end up not loving the movie, I can't imagine watching it and not at least appreciating and understanding the heroic acting effort out of Lily Sullivan here and just the remarkable way a director and writer can use so few elements to make something so interesting. Now let's quickly talk about the finale of True Detective Night Country, which set the internet on fire, as I predicted, was incredibly divisive to fans. The author I was talking about, great horror author Laird Barron, who is very positive on this season and on the finale itself, he tweeted this morning before I recorded this, it's just a TV show, but sure, rent your garments. He's obviously seeing all the hate that's going on. I mean, Nick Pizzolatto's not helping any. The original creator of True Detective, who's reposting all kinds of, like, takedowns of this current season, which is just, like, the slimiest thing to do. I mean, even if you felt that way, as a creator, a franchise who, by the way, this is the most watched season in the history of True Detective, so it's putting money directly in your pocket to just go at it like that. I would much rather he took the John Carpenter, just go get high and say, you know, I'm not going to comment on it when you don't like it, or that it's good when you do like it. His approach is much classier than whatever Nick's doing. But I really enjoyed not just the finale, but the whole season. The reason I warned that I sensed that it was going to be so divisive was I kind of clocked where it was headed in terms of way too on-the-nose references to original True Detective, which I think is a mistake. I think it's a mistake that they made either because they were in awe of the original or they're fans of the original or both. There's a great theory made up by a guy named Harold Bloom, who was a literary critic, that he called the anxiety of influence. And he would talk about how writers that came after other writers, like he would talk about how Tolstoy said that he hated Shakespeare and Shakespeare was the worst or whatever. But if you read Tolstoy's books, you discover that he's doing things with his characters that are like, I can do what Shakespeare did, but better. Or, you know, I'm going to twist what he was trying to do and improve it, which means like you may hate it and you may like be pushing it away from yourself and saying like whatever, but it's in your head. like he's Shakespeare's living rent free in your head. And it's influencing what you do. And there was an influence cast by True Detective Season 1 on True Detective Season 4 that I think was to its detriment overall. I heard somewhere, and I don't know, I didn't follow up, I can't verify this, that Issa Lopez pitched HBO on the idea of the murder mystery, this kind of thing set in Alaska, but it wasn't True Detective. And they said, if you can make it True Detective, we'll finance it or do it or whatever. I long for the version of this that is exactly like what this is without the true detectiveness of it, which I hate because I actually loved how the finale of Night Country came around to the interview trope and concept of True Detective having Jodie Foster sit in front of a camera talking to the two investigators and straight up lying to them all the way down. That wouldn't nearly have as much resonance in a non-True Detective property, so you would lose the impact and coolness of that if it hadn't been a True Detective season. But I just think that there was too high a hill to climb to try to please fans of the first season. And interestingly, in Laird Barron's review of Night Country, he does something what I think is really brave and really perceptive, and you're probably going to start throwing your phone across the room when I say this, but he was poking some holes in True Detective season one in comparison to season four, primarily the fact that he says season one was hinting at supernatural but pulled its punches. Now, I get a lot of people love that it never went supernatural, that it was all kind of just explainable as like drug hallucinations and mental issues. But let's take a step back from the true detectiveness of this all and just talk as horror fans. As horror fans, Night Country was more horror than True Detective season one. And by, at least in my opinion, pretty much definitively eliminating the supernatural elements as possibilities in season one, or as close to as you can, it really was doing what Laird Barron was saying, which was it tried to give itself the gravitas and menace of supernatural threat, and then at the end basically just take it all away and make it like a cosmic perspective thing. And that's another thing he mentions about season one, is it has an incredibly optimistic ending, which I have to confess, given all the bleakness of season one, I felt like was a little tacked on feeling when I first watched it. I mean, the idea of that new Rust Cole that we meet for the last 2 minutes or so of season one going around giving self-help seminars or whatever. I mean, the way he's talking at the end about how the light is greater than the darkness and whatnot. I don't know. So, you know, it's not like season one is this wholly infallible, flawless property. I know there are tons of people out there saying that it is, and it's the greatest season of TV ever and all that stuff. And I super enjoyed it, and I think it's really up there. I personally would take almost any season of The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or all the seasons of Twin Peaks over True Detective season one, but I mean, hate me as much as you want. So let's get to the season four finale. So besides the fact that there are some things that it has a bleaker ending than season one. It has a more supernatural events and possibilities than season one. I just come back to the primary thing that I really enjoyed about Night Country, which is, I loved Ennis. I loved hanging out with the characters. I thought they did what season one did in terms of talking philosophy, in its own way better. I'm trying not to do this because the comparison drives me crazy. I mean, season one is brilliantly written. The dialogue is brilliant. The time is a flat circle, which was grotesquely stolen by season four. Let's be honest. That was terrible. You know, it has these gems, but what I really appreciated about Night Country was the characters would say really brief shit to each other and then stop talking. And it let us fill in the blanks. So they didn't overtalk. There were times in season one where Rust Cole overtalked the concept and went on and on. And in this season, they could get that done in just a sentence or two. The part where Rose is sitting with Peter after they get rid of Peter's father, after she slices his lungs open and the corpse so that the body will sink into the water. Incredible detail. They're sitting there and Rose just says, "You think the worst part is over. It's not fucking over." And then they just sit there. That's all you need. The incredible performance of B, the character explaining to Liz and Navarro what happened to the scientist and why it happened, and her delivery of the lines of, you know, she just took them, she ate their dreams from the inside and spit out their frozen bones. Oh my God, as horror fans, like I see so many people online absolutely saying there's no merit to the season. The finale is the worst thing ever. That line delivery was like Vincent Price-esque. And again, with the ravishing visuals, the Aurora Borealis, the, I forgot to mention in my last episode on True Detective, on Night Country, the cracking of the ice below Navarro's feet is one of the most gorgeous things. I'm going to make it my phone lock screen thing. It's such a beautiful visual. But we got like the Liz falling into the water and being baptized and coming out like not reborn, because she's not all that much different. She's just come to peace with the loss of her child, and she's a little more like, I don't care what you other people are doing or what you believe. I'm just going to do my job, and that's enough for myself. So she's rebaptized into like a better version of herself, a better parent, a better police chief. But the visual of her sinking into the water and the ice and just the shots of this, again, I cannot emphasize how a show set entirely at night is so much better lit and so much more visually rich than so many horror movies with huge budgets who are set like in the fucking daytime, just like in corridors or buildings where you can't see shit because everything is filmed dark nowadays. And I do like the ambiguity of the ending, which Night Country had in common with Monolith. Although in this case, I'm pretty sure Navarro is dead. But unlike with Monolith, where I much preferred one interpretation and feel like the movie's a little less in its impact with the other interpretation, I'm good with both here. I think it's just as excellent either way, whether Navarro's alive and she just lives way out remote in the ice, like, I forget the guy's, T'Gak, one of the characters. Like, she's found her own place to live away from everyone. She's essentially disappeared, but occasionally comes back to hang out with Liz. Or that she's died and she's returned as a spirit. I think they're both great. The problem here is the show gave the True Detective fans who were motivated to not have an open mind, or to be fair, just people who, you know, see this differently than I do, so much meat to hate on it. There are so many ridiculous, unnecessary plot holes. There's so many plot lines that just kind of lead to nowhere or abruptly turn. The whole Kayla-Peter tension that was going throughout the season and then just changes in an instant at the end. That was bad. The time is a flat circle, as we said, was horrible. The handprints that leads to Blair, oh my God, in a lab that was attacked by like a million people driving the scientist out into the blizzard, but the only physical evidence left is like handprints around one place in the lab. I mean, I don't know. Although they do clean the lab, so I guess they just cleaned every flat surface and didn't get to the hatch lid, I suppose. I don't know. The reason I didn't do an episode devoted exclusively to the finale, even though I think it's got enough in it to have deserved that, is I find it too depressing how much hate there is for this. I didn't want to like sled against it for too long because it was going to demoralize me. I don't think it's perfect. I think it's got a lot of flaws. I wish it wasn't True Detective. It had been its own thing, but I really, really enjoyed it. It's like a strangely, I think, going to become a holiday thing for me, like to watch around Christmas or New Year, you know, a couple of years from now, because it's set in that time and it has such a mordant, dark version of the holiday songs and holiday vibes. I think it had a lot of cool things to say. I think it looked unfailingly beautiful in how it was shot. I think it had some actually great, pure horror moments. And I think the acting was phenomenal. I never knew week to week who I was more into. Sometimes I was like, you know, Liz would be talking. I'm like, of course it's Jodie Foster. She's amazing, whatever. And then Hank would show up on the screen. I'm like, oh, thank God, Hank's here. Hank's the best. And then, you know, Peter would show up, and then fucking SpongeBob toothbrush guy would show up, or even some of the bit characters. The Corpsicle would show up on screen. I'd be like, oh my God, that's awesome. Like, I don't know. I know what else to tell you except for I enjoyed it. The finale had its problems, but not enough to dent my affection for what Night Country tried to do, what it tried to say, and what it was built out of. Now, I'm not alone in this. I'll tell you some of the comments from our community real quick. Tracy V, these are all going to be supporters because I didn't do it on the main page. So thank you so much for not just supporting, which helps this podcast go every week, but also for taking the time to comment in the supporter group. If you haven't joined there, this is where you can talk to me and the core of our community directly. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's just $2.99 a month to be in there. You can leave anytime. As soon as you leave, the charges stop. So it's a Facebook group. It's a really, really fun time and a great set of people. I'm the least of the people in there. Unfortunately, there's so many smart, interesting people in there, which we're going to get to. So Tracy V said, I was really curious about what everyone thought of the finale. I couldn't sleep after it for a while. I thought it was good, not great. I thought it was too drawn out, a little too much Danvers Navarro drama that didn't add anything but beneficial. I liked their apples to oranges conflict through the series. I did like how it ended, not wrapped up in a pretty bow. And then she was glad Rose wasn't a ghost. She said a lot more. It's really interesting. But the thing that really stood out to me was that she couldn't sleep after it. This is interesting to me because I get that there's a lot of people who hate this thing. And even some of the people who don't think the finale is great, it still sat with them, right? And not in just like, oh my God, I fucking hated that. I want 2 hours of my life back or whatever, like that kind of sense. There's plenty of that. But in her case, she sort of liked the finale. She liked the season. There were things she had quibbles with and didn't like, but it sat with her. She was still thinking about it. And there's so much content that I consume from Netflix and Max and Prime Video and all that stuff, of stuff that's newer, not the old classic stuff, but it's newer, that I forget 5 minutes after I watched it. It's just gone. Never think about it again. So, and then I see a thumbnail for it. You know, months later, I'm like, oh my God, did I watch that? I guess I did. And this is not that. How much you hate it, this is not that. Sarah Winters said, while it was no season one, I really liked it and was entertained the whole time. And R.C. Martin, brilliant as usual, said, I kept asking myself, did any of this really happen? The fact when they got into Salal Station and Ferris Bueller's Day Off was still playing threw me for a loop. Did they arrive back in time to when the scientists had just died? The story they were told by the cleaning ladies was meant to be the full honest truth and the spiral. They exist everywhere in life, hence the orange peel. Patterns exist everywhere. I thought it was an excellent season that had you as the viewer more connected to the characters than seasons prior. And poor Peter, he was a beaming light to all that darkness. So that is Night Country. At least myself and some of our community are glad it exists and glad we watched it. I'm also super glad you listened. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast, please do. Even if you're only here to hate listen as I praise things that you despise like Night Country and recommend things like Monolith that are slow burns that, you know, you're more into the Dawn of the Dead remake and you're like, what the hell is George even talking about? I'm still glad you're here. Go check out Monolith and let me know via message to the page or in the subscriber group where I'm sure to see it, or a post in the Horror Weekly group itself, or on Threads if you're on Threads. Let me know what you think. It's one of those movies that you want to talk about once you've seen it. That's it for this episode and the impending possible alien inanimate object invasion. Until next Wednesday, have a great Horror Week.